Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with Tommy Goodman, keyboardist, arranger, composer, accompanist, jazz man. At 92, Tommy Goodman is doing what he was drawn to do at 2. Listen to this extraordinary story of a man who just kept pursuing the passion that he recognized it to. Listen to the story his family tells about how 2-year-old Tommy was drawn to the radio and insisted in his baby talk that they play the music. So he's charming, he's delightful, he's got amazing stories. Hang on, here come the show. To The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. As a psychotherapist, it is clear to me that too many of us are demonstrating, presenting aspects of ourselves which may be the truth about us, but are not the whole truth about us. I see over and over again that for many people, their childhood, either in the form of their family of origin, or something that happened to them in school, something a teacher said, or the bullying of peers, something that they experienced in their religious organization or in a cultural organization, told them that something about them was not okay. Something about them would bring criticism, teasing, neglect, sometimes even abuse or trauma. We human beings are remarkably flexible, and so when we discover that there's an aspect of us, a characteristic about us, some way that we think or talk or act, or something that we want or are drawn to, and that is going to bring a consequence that we really don't want, don't like, we are amazingly capable of, at first, pretending that we don't have that. No, I'm really not interested in drawing. I really don't laugh like that. I really don't get angry. And if we keep it up long enough, we become that person. We forget that we had the ability to laugh spontaneously, to get angry, to be interested in drawing. And we come into adulthood without access to all that we are. We come into adulthood, in the cases that I just described, as someone who doesn't laugh spontaneously, is separated from his or her love of art, is unable to demonstrate anger, annoyance, distress. I need hardly say that a life in which one is cheated from important aspects of oneself is not a fully lived life. Not only isn't it a fully lived life, but when you are separated from aspects of yourself, those aspects don't actually go away. They remain. In my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I call the presentation our cover story, very much like what a spy does. That is, the cover story for a spy is designed to allow them to pretend to be someone they're not, because if the who they really are is known, they will be in danger. Same for us. And I call those qualities which we had to give up, for which we're in denial, as our undercover. And that is what they are. They go undercover, but they don't go away. We don't lose them. And when you have had to suppress something about yourself, for instance, your ability to demonstrate anger or annoyance, you always know that there's something wrong, something false, something flawed about you that you're not able to accept, demonstrate. You hear people say that they feel, ooh, if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. Or the old Woody Allen joke, you know, I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have me. This self-contempt, this is based on the unconscious knowledge that there are things about us we are not copping to. Unfortunately, many of those things are wonderful things which we had to deny. So the Linjo is about saying, if this happened to you, if you're aware that there is something that you would want to do that would make your life easier, for example, being able to tell somebody that they hurt your feelings or that they made you angry, or that you were able to spontaneously erupt in joy and delight instead of second-guessing yourself and seeing whether that behavior would be all right, if that happened to you, or if there's something that you would really like to do, like draw, but you can't make yourself do it, it may not be too late to recover what your childhood might have cheated you out of. And if you want to talk to me about that, then go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. Click on the email tab, ask me any questions, I'll be happy to answer you. In my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. Because at least in the aspect of their art, these people are who they really are. And the interview I'm airing today with Tommy Goodman is a perfect example. As I said in the run-up, Tommy seemed to know at the age of 2 that music was what his life would be about. And you can hear how he made a life of music over and over again, growing, adding, becoming more, pursuing excellence in every way that he knew how. And so that now at 92, he can still be bringing pleasure to us and enjoying the passion of his life. Here now is Tommy Goodman. Okay, so I'm here with Tommy Goodman, musician, composer, teacher, keyboardist. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm explaining to Tommy that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And it seems clear to me that the art to which you have given your life and made your living is the art of music?
That is correct.
Oh, good. Okay, good. So, actually, I only ask one question. And that is, do you remember, can you tell me, the very first moment in your life when music called to you, seemed interesting, compelled you, any of that?
Well, I can't remember exactly one, although I've been told there was one when I was a very small kid.
Tell me the one you've been told.
2 years old or something.
2 years
like
old.
That. And I spoke baby talk. And apparently I was always walking or first crawling toward the radio. And I said something, I don't know, it's like play the Moody. You know?
Oh,
so my mother says.
Yes.
I have no reason not to believe her.
Of course not. No, of course not.
So the next thing I remember was really, you know, I started with classical music.
So does that mean that you took lessons?
Oh, sure.
Always. Do you remember, how old were you when you started?
Well, maybe 7.
And do you remember if you asked for the lessons or it simply was, this is
what
we do?
Well, I remember that I wanted to play the violin first. And there was just too much scraping involved. I couldn't stand it. It was too difficult. I was too young. And then I tried something else. I don't remember. Oh, yes. Well, that was a little later when I was about 12, 11 or 12. I had the measles. You know, in those days, they drew all the shades down. It was supposed to be bad for your eyes or something like that. And some distant cousin brought me a soprano saxophone, which looks something like a clarinet, it's straight,
mm-hmm.
an instruction book. So I sat there in the dark for about 6 weeks, and I taught myself a little saxophone, which I continued playing as a kind of a sideline all through high school.
Before you got the measles, you were already taking piano lessons. Is that what you're saying or not?
Say that again.
And before you got the measles, before 12, or, you know.
Oh, yes.
So you've taken lessons from 7.
Well, I'd been playing fairly advanced stuff by the time I was about 10 or 11. And as a matter of fact, my parents were faced with a decision because my then teacher, who was part of a famous two piano team of those days, Lubushots and Nemanov, his name is Pierre Lubushots, and he wanted my parents to take me out of school and train me for a concert piano career. But that meant, you know, quite a different upbringing. And my parents finally decided that was not, quote, normal enough.
Yes.
I don't know what would have happened if it went the other way, but this was fine. And the next thunderbolt about music, and it was really a thunderbolt, was when I was about 11 or 12, I heard the first Benny Goodman record. And that set me really up.
Okay, so up until now, you're studying classical music, right?
Yeah.
And
I was playing fairly advanced stuff, like Mozart and Cherry, you know.
Okay, so I'm just curious. You wanted to play the violin, but that was too hard or too scratchy. So did you say, well, what about the piano? Did they say, well, what about the piano?
Oh, good question. My father, who had been a music publisher and a lyric writer and in Penn Alley for a while, said, well, you know, the piano is the basis of everything. And that was considered then and probably now still sort of the most reliable way of looking at a career in music, because the piano in itself is kind of an orchestra.
Well, wait. So, you're seven. Are you thinking about a career in music? Are they thinking about a career in music for you?
Yes, because it was brought up by my teacher, as I said.
But not when you started. Not when you started piano.
No, just soon.
Maybe
after,
yeah, right.
Soon after, when I was maybe 8 or 9, when I was already playing fairly advanced stuff.
Yeah.
My parents had to decide, and that's when my father chimed in with a remark about studying the piano and. Well, that was a little earlier.
Yeah. No. I got the chronology.
Yeah.
I'm just interested. From before you were a teenager, it was already decided essentially that you would have a career, that your life would be about music. No.
Yeah, I don't feel that my parents decided for me. I mean, I was already to that extent. You get passionate. Well, you do when you're 12 or 13.
Mm-hmm.
The hormones start to run around,
mm-hmm.
and so it was a very strong, visceral reaction. To jazz.
Yeah.
So then both were going. Yeah. I started to play club dates when I was a kid, 13 or 14.
Really?
Yeah.
So now you're studying the classical music and you're apparently very gifted at it, right? So did you study, contemporary, did you study jazz? Did you just listen to records?
No.
And then you figured it out?
It wasn't until way in my career and almost my retirement that I really studied jazz.
Well, let's go back. Okay, so you're a teenager, you're studying in classical music, you're doing extremely well at that, now you're playing club dates, assuming you're making some money at that, right?
Yeah, I never had an allowance.
You didn't?
Because I was always making more money than I could use, really. So I used to buy records and books.
Yeah. Okay, so where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn until I was about, in New York,
mm-hmm.
until I was about 12 and a half. Then we moved to Rochester because my father got a better job. That was after Prohibition, and he had switched careers into the wine and liquor business.
Ah, he went from one obsession to another, music to booze, right? I mean, from one of those,
well,
right?
Music to be an impolite word, booze.
Yeah, right.
Although he used to call himself Two Drink Goodman.
Okay, so he was a music publisher and a lyric writer?
Yeah.
So music really was in your house. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it was sort of in
your blood.
My father
was crazy about actually show business. So I think he was always hoping I would be, another, I don't know, Fats Waller or something.
Really?
And my mother, I remember, took me mostly to concerts.
Ah.
So I always had two things going.
Yes.
And I still do.
Yes.
When I play a jazz date, I often come home and listen to classical music and vice versa.
Yeah.
Or vice versa.
I got it. Okay. All right. So young, you already know what you're going to do with your life.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you go to school?
Yep.
High school, college?
Because of that decision of my parents,
yes,
not to take me out of normal schooling and
right.
do something else. When we moved to Rochester, I went to high school there, a normal high school, a very good one, by the way. And Rochester, of course, is the home of the Eastman School of Music, and I used to go down there and hang around all the time and listen to the orchestras. And I got fascinated with the orchestra sound. And I thought, oh, I want to maybe write music.
Uh-huh.
That might be a nice thing to do. And
so now you're in high school, essentially,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But somewhere along there, fairly early, maybe 11, 12, 13, no, yeah. My father, who had a kind of thing he did in his business, which was he wrote lyrics to existent songs, and he used to have sales meetings and do them partly in music.
Mm-hmm.
And he would sing them. He was a very good performer. I mean, I think his ambition really was to be, the George M. Cohan.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
That was his dream. And Anyway, he was very good at it. And he took me to a home of a famous songwriter named J. Russell Robinson, who wrote many old hits like Dinah and a half dozen others, Portrait of Jenny a little bit later. And he showed him a lyric that he had written, because previous to that, he'd written to this one song all the time, Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Sheen.
I know it.
I heard it last night on one of the television shows.
Yeah, uh-huh.
There was a reference to it. I think Johnny Mercer sang it. It was Johnny Mercer and Bing Crosby. They were singing a duet. It was very funny. Johnny Mercer was a really good performer, good singer.
I know.
And probably the best singer of his own songs, except for one or two people.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, where was I?
That your father brought the lyric to the songwriter.
Yeah. So there we were. And my father showed the lyric to Russell Robinson. And so he immediately went into the kitchen to another room. He says, well, let me look at it, you know. And he came back in about less than 10 minutes, and he had the whole tune composed.
Oh, he'd written music to it?
Yes. And so I was, like, stunned. And I said, that's what I want to do. I want to do what he did. I want to write music.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't clear what kind of music. It still isn't. Because I've written a lot of both.
So did you study composition?
I had a very... you might say, highfalutin classical experience. I went to after the Army.
Oh, wait, let's back up. Okay. So you get out of high school, you go into the Army?
Well, I had 1 year at the Eastman School.
Oh,
and yes. Then I volunteered and I was rejected. They had their quota, so I had to wait the next year. And then I was drafted officially. And after basic training, I ended up in an Army band. And that was a great experience because there were some very good players, including Louis Belson, who was one of the famous drummers of
the time. I know
who
he is. Mm-hmm.
And we became sort of lifelong friends, and I did some arranging and composing for him along the way.
Okay, so I'm just curious, did you want to be in the Army?
Who wants to be in the Army?
That's what I thought. You were...
No. It wasn't quite that. It really wasn't. Because that was... It's been called the Good War. And
I was a fairly
political person.
Ah, okay, good.
At an early age. And I felt this was... And also Jewish.
Yeah, I know.
And I felt a calling. I really did.
What year are we talking here?
We're talking 1941.
Oh, yeah, right in the middle.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so, but you didn't fight, you were in the Army band.
Yeah, and I was an arranger and also pianist.
Okay, so by this time, you've already started arranging, maybe doing some composing and stuff, right?
And they had a wonderful Red Cross program for the guys there. It was very sad getting there to begin with, although I was very happy not to be sent to the Anzio B shed, which my old unit was. Very sad too. But anyway, this was at in Washington. It was the annex to Walter Reed Hospital, and it was a huge place which had been a very fancy girls' school called the National Park Seminary, something like that. And the very beautiful grounds and all kinds of great buildings and so on. And there were about 1,500 soldiers, and unfortunately, almost all of them were amputees. Right. So it was quite a shock for those first month or so. But, you know, then one gets used to what one has to get used to. So we were very busy with the band. We rehearsed and played concerts during the day, and then there were several smaller units. Louis Belson had a sextet, and we played many dances all around town in Arlington, Virginia. And That was fun. And also, I was saying the Red Cross had a very enlightened program for these guys to keep busy and interested. And what they did was they did radio plays. You know, some of the early really good ones by Norman Corwin. And
mm-hmm. I interviewed Norman.
Did you?
He was 100 at the time.
Well, somebody's older than I am.
Yes, anyway. Well.
Was.
Right.
Anyway, and there I got a chance to compose background music, sort of like writing for films, or this mm-hmm. was radio plays.
Mm-hmm.
So I was already very interested in composing and arranging besides playing.
Okay, and you're not very old at this point. You're in your 20s, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you get out of the war, you get out of the army, and then what do you do?
I go back to school.
Ah.
As a matter of fact, the next day after I was discharged, I went to the Library of Congress and I started looking through college catalogs to see what music schools had to offer and the normal schools which had music departments and so on. And I found out that famous contemporary composer, no longer contemporary, but at that time he was contemporary, Paul Hindemith was teaching at Yale. And I said, oh boy, that's where I'm going. And that's just a whole long story in itself. But I finally did get to study with him, and there were 2 years of working with him, and then he took off and for a sabbatical. It was supposed to be 1 year. I turned into two. The first year he gave lectures at Harvard, and the second year I don't know what he did. But he didn't come back to school. Meanwhile, I got the idea that, well, I'm going to, nothing but the best, you know, I'm going to look for another great teacher. And of course, one of the great teachers until fairly recently was the French woman teacher, Nadia Boulanger, who taught Scopeland and Barber and all those people. And I said, well, you know, stars and all that stuff. And I figured, well, why not? What the hell?
Yeah, really, what have you had to lose?
Well.
Right.
And I had a GI Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
So they paid for everything.
Wow.
And I was in Paris for about a year and a half, two summers at the school in Fontainebleau, and then spent the winter, and I lived with a French family. And
God, that must have been wonderful.
Oh, it was just terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a bunch of American students who were there that, you know, we had a kind of gang.
Yeah.
And at that time, it was still feeling a post-war, right? There were shortages, but that didn't matter because you could go to a concert for, that was when the American dollar was very strong. And you could go to the best concerts down for 35 cents,
mm-hmm.
or the opera.
Yeah.
And so I guess at that time I was really not into jazz at all.
No, because you were studying with all these classical teachers, right?
I mean, I always listened to it, but...
Right, but you weren't playing it.
No, my thought was, well, I'll have a career in academia.
Oh, yes.
I'll end up teaching and
composing,
something like that, which didn't happen. Because of some personal financial needs, when I graduated, there I was in Paris. I came back, and then spent another 2.5 years at Yale with Hindemith.
Wow!
So you know, I had a good portfolio.
Sheesh. Yeah, but not for playing jazz necessarily.
No, not at that point. As a matter of fact, I never really got into playing jazz until, now that I think of it, when I went to New York because of this financial needs and so on, and I did some little teaching and some little school in New Jersey, I remember, and I started playing some club dates. But I wanted to get a job where I had a lot of free time. I'm laughing at it. Is that some of that free time for the first years when I did start playing musical shows on Broadway, and I was very lucky.
What did you play?
Hit shows. Piano.
No, I understand that. What shows?
Oh, the first show was Silk Stockings.
Oh, my.
With Don Amici and Hildegard Neff, I think it was.
Right. Who wrote it? Who was the composer?
Cole Porter.
Cole Porter, that's what I thought. Wow.
Yeah, so the next 10 years, I really had the chance to meet a lot of the big lights in the show business.
Yeah, really. And play some amazing music.
Yeah, because I was often the first one to seize a lot of those songs, which became hits and so on and so forth.
What, do you remember any other shows that you...
Oh, yeah, sure. There were several... there were a number in the middle. There were Bells of Ringing, that's one with Judy Holliday, and a few others. Sammy Davis, The Golden Boy.
Golden Boy.
Which led to working with him for a while.
I saw a Golden Boy on Broadway, and he came out at the end of the show, and he said,
right.
I need people to come to the show, tell people to come to the show. I couldn't know him.
Well, what he did at the end of the show, if you remember.
Yeah, he would do his act.
He and he was always on, but in a nice way.
Oh, God,
he just was crazy for show business, and he knew everything. I mean, what I mean, not only all the tunes and the lyrics, but he knew everything about the television and acting and dancing, of course.
Yeah.
Because he grew up that way.
He was brilliant.
And it was a great show. It was a wonderful band. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of great jazz players in that band. So that was a terrific experience. I also wrote some music for dancing.
Mm-hmm. For the choreography.
The choreography, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then you went on to work on his TV show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was about an 8-month run. That was great.
You know, there's a joke about Sammy Davis Jr. He wakes up in the middle of the night and opens his refrigerator and the light hits him and he does 10 minutes.
I never
heard
of
that one. That's the
That's
only...
very good. I love that.
Right.
The one I know is something like, well, how's everything, Sammy? Well, not so good. He said, you know, I don't know what else can happen to me. You know, I was born black.
Right.
I've just changed to the Jewish faith, and I have only one eye that works. He said, I'm not too happy.
Right.
What else could happen?
Right. He was an amazing man.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, he was an amazing man.
Much more than just a singer.
Oh, God.
Good singer.
God, he was... No, he could do everything.
He was Mr. Show Business.
He really was. And I think that when he died, they turned all the lights out in Las Vegas. I mean, he was an amazing guy, you know. So, okay, so you work with Sammy Davis Jr. Well, you're on the fast track now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're playing with all these, you know, hotshot Broadway composers, and now you're on TV. So, and what are we talking about, the 60s here? The 50s?
We're talking about 60s.
Yeah, the 60s, okay. So then what?
Well, all the time... To tell you a funny anecdote. The last show I played was The Unsinkable Molly Brown. Oh, I left out something rather interesting. I had a work with Frank Lesser. I played The Most Happy Fella.
Uh-huh.
Before that, I worked with him for about a year. It was kind of an assistant. I mean, he wasn't very schooled musically, but he had it all in his head. And he kind of wrote it down in a very rudimentary fashion. And so I sort of, I don't know what you'd call it. I didn't write it, except now and then I would change a little something that was not, like correcting grammar. I was really basically in the creative side with him. It was getting it ready to be copied.
Mm-hmm, got it.
If it was going to be copied. Well, it was going to be finally orchestrated for the show.
Yeah, right.
Just for piano.
You know they're doing Guys and Dolls at the Oslo now.
Yeah, so I heard.
Yeah.
But I learned an awful lot from him about show business, about theater, musical theater. And I remember in those days, I loved all kinds of music, except opera. I couldn't relate to it. Well, that changed later in my life. But, and I did write an opera.
Okay, back up. So how did you get in... contact with, I mean, how did the relationship with Frank Lesser start?
The conductor of the show that I was working at the time, which was, what was it, I forget. Oh, it was, Music Man. Ah. That was a long run. It was about 2.5 years.
No kidding.
And on the last night of the show, the conductor passed me a note, and he knew Frank. And he said, not to worry, he said, I made an appointment with you for a meeting with Frank Lesser tomorrow morning.
You'll go from one job to another, right? That's great.
So that was very exciting. You know?
Yeah.
And he turned out to be a very wonderful guy to work with, to work for or work with, because he was very democratic and, you know, just a man of the people.
Really?
He spoke very freely. I mean, I was able to voice whatever I thought was needed, and he, you know.
He didn't have a thick skin.
No.
Wow. Well,
he had a thick skin. No, I mean,
he didn't have a thin skin. Right. Yeah. Got it backwards. Sorry. Right.
All right.
So you worked with him, and then you did A Most Happy Fella with him?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I played the show for, I don't know, 6 or 8 months.
Right. Wow. So you were a busy guy.
Yeah, but all the time. And then the next show was Music Man, I think. And then came another Meredith Wilson show, which was The Unsinkable Molly Brown. Mm-hmm. And by that time, I said, well, now or never. I mean, I'm playing piano and things are fine and so on and so forth. I get a little coaching and teaching. And a lot of fishing. I get crazed about fishing. And I'm sitting... there was a very talented trumpet player, caricaturist, you might say, in the band. He used to pass around notes all the time and draw pictures. And he sent around a picture of me at an upright piano with two, I forget what they call
fishing
them.
Balls, right? No?
What?
Fishing balls?
No. Two, the thing when you're going for big fish.
I don't know what that's called.
It permits the line, a certain amount of line to go out, and so it doesn't break. I forget what the hell they call them.
I can see it, though.
Yeah, you've seen them on the boats, you know.
No, I mean, I can picture the picture of you at the piano with the things, right?
And then he has a big can of worms in the bass clef and all kinds of lures all over the piano, you know, and a pail of water, you know, with little fish in it. That was very funny, but it wasn't too funny because it was now or never, you know, you're going to give up this life, this kind of life. You want to write? Okay. So I quit the show. It was Unsinkable Molly Brown. But the funny incident that I remembered was I was so into leaving the show that it turned out that in the show, the opening of the second act, it was, I think Tammy Grimes was playing the part. And she was trying to be a fancy lady. So she's sitting with the piano and trying to learn the Chopin Minute Waltz. And of course, I'm sitting in the pit right around where she is. And I have to start playing a little, you know. I'll show you on the piano. Maybe
okay, yeah.
Kind of fun. But I must have played this thing more than 1,000 times in rehearsals and on the road and on Broadway for a year and a half. So I got to this part. And it seems like the ultimate, because I'll keep playing it. And I'm playing it. I couldn't stop.
And poor Tammy is
so
sitting up on the stage.
I saw my analyst the next day. He said, well, I didn't want to quit the show. No. Anyway, that's...
Was that a joke about the analyst?
Well, I had already decided. I knew what had happened.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so you quit the show because you wanted to write your own music. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that sounds a little highfalutin, my own music, but that's...
It doesn't sound so highfalutin.
No. Well, okay.
I mean, it sounds like a legitimate desire.
You got it. I accept the correction. Anyway, So I set out to... Meanwhile, I had gotten married. I had a little child, named Jody. And I didn't want to go out on the road. I did some for a little while. I was conducting and arranging for a few people who were doing a lot of the big clubs at the time, like Ed Ames and Florence Henderson and so on and so forth. And although it was, you know, kind of an easy job and I enjoyed it, I had a family. I didn't want to leave New York. Mm-hmm. And there was very little that was, you might say, steady work. It was all mostly freelance work, mm-hmm. Except for the classical orchestras and the Met and a few things like that, and Broadway. And I didn't want to work nights for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. So I took some private lessons in commercial arranging and composition and jazz work. And it turned out that the only thing really that paid enough money for me to support myself and family was writing musical commercials. Uh-huh. And that was a very tough field to get and break into. So I knocked on 101 doors, and the 102nd guy was like what I showed him. I had never done a commercial, but I put together an audition reel, you know, mm-hmm. edited so it sounded like commercials, you know, and various styles of music, because I've always liked very many styles. So that turned out to be my strong point.
Yeah, yeah.
They would hire, you know, agencies would hire certain guys who said, well, he can write like that band, you know, like Chicago or 10 Wheel Drive or something like that, or Blood, Sweat, and Tears, or, oh, but he can write like Enoch Light, you know, or whatever. But having been conversant with a lot of styles of music, including a lot of classical music, I started to do work for this one fellow N.W. Ayer, and he was the music producer there, Michael Cohen, mm-hmm. a good composer himself. And little by little, after about a year, I sort of had a business going, writing commercials. And I did that, plus writing some music for soaps, mm-hmm. and beginning to write some jazz arrangements here and there. And so
when you start getting known,
really into writing, I was really getting what I wanted career-wise, which is making my living writing, mm-hmm. rather than playing. So I hardly did any playing at all, except on a few sessions, you know, and so on. Long, because you know, when I wrote on assignment,
yeah, it's deadline.
It was almost overnight sometimes.
Yeah.
A day or two, and then, but it was immediate gratification,
right?
Which was, you know, not often that you have that experience as a composer,
right,
or an arranger. So that was a wonderful, satisfying experience, mm-hmm. and the studio musicians, you know, are just terrific. They're probably the best all around musicians in the world, mm-hmm. in New York, and in California for the movies. So it was it was a very exciting business, very satisfying. That went very well, and I enjoyed the hell out of it.
So it's interesting to me, at 11 or so, mm-hmm. you have this experience with your father giving the lyric to, was it Russell Robinson?
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying, I want to do that. And then, how old are you when you finally...
35, maybe.
Right, so by 35... you're actually doing what you decided you wanted to do, yeah. at 11.
Yeah.
That's great. That's great. A lot of people never get to do what they
want
to do.
Yeah, it's a long arc.
Well, it's not as long an arc. I mean, it is. It's a fairly long arc, but lots of people never get to do...
I know.
Yeah. So then are you saying that the bulk of your career was then writing commercials, writing for soaps, doing some arranging like that?
Film work and, you know, I got to do many specials. Although it was really great because it was writing, like writing film music. Although the assignments were sort of like, okay, I want 10 pieces, two minute length pieces. I said, what kind of music? He said, well, something pastoral. Or light motion. No. He said, motion. I said, what do you mean? I know what motion is. He said, well, you know, any kind of motion. Slow motion, fast motion. So it was very free.
Yes, it was.
And
it was
we had at that time, we had an 18-piece crack studio band. Uh-huh. And they could sight read the phone book.
Yeah.
If necessary. And so that was great. And then the budgets got lower, and I started to work with synthesizers a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
In the last year or two that I did that work. But most of it was commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an exciting kind of work. Because as I say, I kind of had whatever reputation I had was as an eclectic.
Yes, that you could do what
writer.
Was needed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. Okay, so that's New York City. When did you wind up in Sarasota?
Well, I had some friends who lived down in Pelican Cove, South Miami. And I became I did the usual thing snowbirds do, you know, you come for a couple of weeks, then you come for 2 months, then you come for 3 months, 4 months, and then you meet a really nice lady.
I see. Right.
I have been married and so on and so forth, but my wife had passed on. So Lily and I sold our houses up north. And moved everything, tried to jam everything into this place. So I don't know how we managed to do it, but I guess we did. And so we live in this community called Cascades, and it's a nice location. We have most things within reach. Well, we're not kids anymore, so I'm not going to give away her age, just to tell you, I'm almost 92.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Lily's a painter and sculptor. And we go to many, many concerts and galleries and so on and so forth. That's why we love Sarasota. Special kind of small city.
Yes.
It has so many opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you're playing at Burns Court Cafe on Friday nights.
That's right.
Are you playing or writing at all any other place or any other thing?
Well, I do, yeah. First Methodist Church on Pineapple Avenue, just south of Main Street.
Right.
And we play 6 or 7 concerts there during the season.
Yeah, right, you so. And Johnny Moore on drums and Dominic
Mancini
on bass.
You know them?
I do.
Yeah, I play at a place called Allegro Bistro.
Oh, yeah.
I was playing there every Tuesday, but about 2 years ago, I cut it down to every other week, every other Tuesday. And now I've cut it back to once a month. And then I play a number of private parties,
mm-hmm.
Usually with a trio,
mm-hmm.
or at least a bass player. Although I did a job on solo piano at Lakewood Ranch, last weekend, would seem to go well. I'll probably get to do some more work there, but I don't want to do that much.
No, yeah, you're doing as much as you want.
Yeah, I feel myself very lucky.
So that actually is part of the last question I have, which is, having given a life, and my God, you have given a life to music. If you figure from 2 that you were already drawn to the radio. And 7, you were already playing. What would you say about what a life dedicated to music is, what it means to you, what you think about it?
A great deal.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a big understatement. Mm. Well, it feels very good. I feel, as I say, I feel very fortunate.
Yes.
In that many people are discouraged from going into the arts because it doesn't have the future financial rewards that being a lawyer, a doctor, or a dentist, or a God knows what, mm-hmm. a stockbroker, a hedge fund manager, you know. But, you know, if you're passionate about it and you really work hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's clear that that's what you do.
Nothing good comes without really hard work.
Yeah, that's a great place to stop. Would you play for me?
Sure.
Good. Special, very talented Tommy Goodman playing My Romance. And if you want to hear Tommy, you want to hear more music like this, you can catch him every Friday night at the Burns Court Cafe, which is on Pineapple in Sarasota. And you can get him one Tuesday a month at the Allegro Bistro restaurant, which is in Venice. And I imagine that you can find out which Tuesday that is by calling the Allegro Bistro. So, listening to Tommy talk about his life, talk about the way he was drawn first to one kind of music, then another kind of music, listening to the way he pursued relentlessly achieving a higher and higher standard of performance, a higher and higher standard of understanding about this thing that he had fallen in love with so young, music. And he says that he really began to study jazz very late in life, but as you can hear, he's quite accomplished at that. So again, as you are listening to Tommy, it is my hope that you are asking yourself, is this the way I have felt about my life, in which I never got bored with being who I am? Am I my real self? And of course, when I say that about being your real self, I'm not just talking about what you do for a living or what your hobby is. I'm talking about the way you present yourself in the world. Do you let people know who you are? When you're happy, when you're sad, when you're anxious. Are you demonstrating your whole self? Or are you holding back? Are you second guessing? Are you apprehensive? Are you shy about who you are? So, as I said in the opening, if there is something about your life that's not working the way you would like it to, if you think you had to leave a particular aspect of yourself behind, or if there's some way you really want to be but are afraid to risk, and you want to talk to me about that, please do go up on my website, thelinshow.com, and ask me any questions that you might have. So, as always, I hope that you got something from this show that you can use. Maybe it's only just hearing the delightful Tommy Goodman play. Maybe it's finding out where you can hear more of this music. Maybe it's being inspired. Maybe you learned something that you didn't know before. Maybe you heard something that you knew but had forgotten. Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too. You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten